Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's October 6th, 2017 program, Companion Animals and Service Animals, What's the Difference? This is the fifth program in our 2017-2018 program year. I'm Sandra Bishop, City Club President. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. Become a member of City Club at cityclubofeugene.org. Support for City Club is provided by members and sponsors, including Capella Market, AARP Oregon, Evans, Elder, Brown, and Subert Commercial Real Estate, and Gatos, Churnside, and Balthrop Attorneys. And special thanks to PacInfo Internet Solutions and KLCC Radio. City Club programs are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 at 6:30 p.m. on Monday following the program. The coordinator of today's program is Ralph Pledger. And Ralph, would you stand up? We'd like to thank Ralph for organizing this important discussion. And now I'd like to introduce our speakers today. This is a special treat for City Club. We have a couple of folks here today, Erica Organ and Eugene Organ, and they are associated with the Lane Independent Living Alliance, LILA. And Erica is an Access and Training Associate in the Oregon ADA Center, a program of Lane Independent Living Alliance, LILA. And she was employed at LILA as part of the Oregon ADA Center for about 10 years, has been for about 10 years. She's certified ADA coordinator through the University of Missouri, ADA coordinators training and certification project. And she's also, as an ADA access and training associate, she's conducted access surveys and trainings throughout the state. And Eugene is the coordinator of the Oregon ADA Center, a program of LILA. And LILA, sorry, thank you, LILA. Eugene has been involved with the Americans with Disability Act, the ADA, since before its passage. So he will be a font of wisdom when it comes to the Q&A time. For 13 years, he was employed as the executive director of the Oregon Disabilities Commission. He also worked with the Oregon State Legislature as an advocate for legislation relating to persons with disabilities. And I just want to add a little note that wasn't in any of the notes, but I believe that Erica and Eugene were instrumental in bringing the federal government into line and getting a ramp at the new federal courthouse. So they are activists. One of their mottos is, we don't know when to stop. So it's a pleasure today to introduce them and allow them to make our presentation. Thanks.
Thank you very much. My name is Erica, like she said, and we're with the Oregon ADA Center by LILA. LILA is the local independent living center here in Eugene, and our mission is to help people with disabilities connect with the resources and programs they need in order to live independently in the community, either to move out of the institutions and nursing homes into an independent living situation or maintain their independence in the home they're already in. So that's the mission of any independent living center. There are 9 of them here in Oregon. And LILA is the one that operates represents Lane County. So today we're going to talk just a little bit about the difference between some confusion around what a service animal is under the Americans with Disabilities Act and what a companion animal is and what the laws say about where they can and can't go. And so we're going to start with Dad's going to talk a little bit here about the history of service animals and the ADA's definition.
Just for the record, my name is Eugene Organ. I did not change it when I moved here. I get that question quite frequently, and I'm thinking, people actually think you change your name to the city you live in? It would have been hell when I lived in St. Paul. We're here today to talk about service animals. As you may have noticed, in recent years, there seems to be a plethora of animals running around town, attached to people who are wearing cute little vests, the animal that is, are wearing the cute little vests or have service animal credentials, and there's a lot of confusion. And so I want to go back a little bit in terms of the history of service animals. Probably the first service animals that any of us can remember are dog guides for the blind. And you notice I put dog first because they are first and foremost a dog. But they were well accepted and pretty common among people who are blind to have a service animal who is a dog that can guide them through the everyday living. In a few years later, several years later, the hearing ear dog was developed. And those are animals that are trained to help people who are deaf to hear what is going on in their community, in their life. They can answer doors, they can alert people to any number of kind of incidents that may be affecting their lives. After that, I think, came the canine companions. The canine companions are animals, dogs once again, that assisted people in wheelchairs who had mobility issues. I happen to have the pleasure of meeting the very first canine companion, whose name was Abdul. He was a black lab, and he had been trained to recognize 73 voice commands. He was a remarkable dog. His handler was unable to reach very high in any situation, and so when she got on an elevator, Abdul was trained to push all the buttons. Now, she had to stop at every floor before she got to the one she was getting to, but eventually she got to the floor she needed to be at. And that was indeed a service for her. And it was a reasonable accommodation to accommodate her particular disability. Abdul also was trained, I don't know how he did it, was trained to get her favorite candy bar from a vending machine. Now, don't ask me how that transpired. I never saw it, so I don't know. But that was the story, at least, that he was trained to do that. So service animals can be trained to do any number of activities for a person who has a disability. They are indeed a reasonable accommodation. When, in 1990, when the ADA was passed, the service animals were written into the law, or into the regulations for the law. At that point, it was a very wide open definition. Any animal that provided a service was considered a service animal. So we had dogs who were considered service animals, but we also had any number of other species of animals. We had ferrets who were, people said, were their service animal. We had cats. We had pythons.
We once turned a service python away from the Lane County Fair. Decided that the python in the barns would spook the animals and cause a direct threat and alter the nature of the event. And so that's why we denied the service python entrance to the Lane County Fairgrounds.
So there were, people just went wild in terms of what animals they could call a service animal. And at that point, it was any animal who performed a function for a person with a disability. That was the definition. Well, in 2010, the U.S. Department of Justice altered that definition. and effective in 2010, only dogs could be considered service animals. So gone are the pythons, the ferrets, the cats, the birds. All of them are no longer considered a service animal. Perhaps one of the most common among non-dog service animals was the monkey. Helping Hands was the name of the organization, and they provided chimpanzees for people to use in their homes. And they are no longer considered a service animal under the ADA. So now the ADA says that the animal must be individually trained to provide a service, a task, for a person with a disability. The animal must be, of course, housebroken. The animal must be under the control of the individual with a disability. That generally means tethered or on a leash. There are a couple of exceptions. If the person's disability does not allow them to handle a leash or any kind of apparatus to control the animal, then voice commands are certainly allowed. And the animal then must be under voice control of the individual with a disability. Additionally, the animal must be performing a task for the person with a disability, a task that the individual cannot perform him or herself. That means that the work in terms of the guidance from the Department of Justice. The animal must actually perform a task. What this means for service animals is that the law says a service animal must be admitted to any place of public accommodation. That means a business, a store, a health care unit, an ambulance, transportation systems.
In fact, Uber just is settling a lawsuit now, just settled like 2 months ago a lawsuit regarding their drivers not allowing service animals. So they're even coming down on taxis and private transportation modes too.
So that the service animals must be admitted in those situations. In order to determine if an animal is a service animal, there are only two questions that can be asked. One is the animal required for a disability or used for a disability? You cannot ever ask the person what their disability is. You can only ask a general question, is the animal needed for or required for a disability? Secondly, you can ask, what task has the animal been individually trained to perform? You cannot ask for a demonstration, but you can ask the question as to what tasks. Erica, do you want to talk about
so
that?
I want to sneak in one thing that you skipped over, is you forgot about the horses.
Oh, I was going to get back to horses.
So when he said dogs only now, the law says individually trained to provide services, they did make one exception. Because there are people out there who need service animals who are allergic to dogs, allergic to dander. And so they decided to go ahead and leave miniature horses as an option for a service animal. And when we say miniature horses, we're talking about no more than about 2 feet high at the shoulder. They weigh about 100 pounds. So they're about the same size as a large dog. And they have little booties they put on their feet so they don't damage floors when they walk inside. And they can be housebroken. And they're trained, and they can be trained to do anything a dog can do. The nice thing for people about horses is they live a lot longer, and so they can serve a whole lot longer. And because there's a big disruption in somebody with a disability's life when they have to train a new service animal. They have to retire a service dog and train a new one. And if they are going through a school like Seeing Eye, it costs them quite a bit of money as well. Now, the state and federal law do allow you to just train your own service animal. You do not have to go to a school. you can train your own. But if they do go to a school, it's quite expensive. And either way, it's a disruption in your life to have to train a new service dog. So horses can actually serve for about twice as long as dogs can, sometimes three times as long as dogs can. So that was the decision, and leaving miniature horses as an exception was so people who were allergic to dander could still have a service animal, and they can serve so much longer that they provide a lot longer service. Anyway, most of those are on the East Coast. There is one here in Lane County now somewhere, because we got a call from a school district last year about it. So I haven't seen it yet, but there is one here in Lane County attached to a child.
They started off on the East Coast. They're moving westward towards us, but because they have short legs, they're not going very fast. They were last sighted in Iowa, I think. But they are legitimate service animals if they are individually trained to perform a task for an individual with a disability.
So when we talk about tasks, we talk about guide dogs, that's pretty clear, hearing ear dogs. Some of the ones we don't see so much is there are dogs that are trained to smell a difference in the owner's scent and pH and let them know that their blood sugar's dropping if they're diabetic, so that they can either take medicine or get some food in their system. That's a legitimate service animal. But you don't see the task, but that's part of why they say you can't ask them to demonstrate. Could you have a seizure right now so we can see how your dog does its task? Right. Obviously, there's some tasks that they just can't demonstrate. Seizure alert dog is another one where they're trained to notice things and changes in the person's behavior and body maneuverings that allow them to alert them to an oncoming seizure. So there are some really neat tasks out there. And one of the things we want to make sure we talk about is the difference between a companion animal. We've talked about companion animals versus service animals. A companion animal is any animal who's, by very being in your life, has some sort of therapeutic or emotional benefit to the person. So it can be any kind of animal, and just their presence in your world helps mitigate a problem with your disability. But there's no specific task training required. So the ones that say, it's a service animal, it just keeps me from freaking out without any task, that's a companion animal.
Those are called pets.
Those are not covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act for places of public accommodation. Those are not allowed into restaurants, stores, buildings. We have been known for non-food vending places to tell folks. We got a call from, I think it was the library a couple years ago. They had a little girl with autism who couldn't leave. She was like 5. Her parents were trying to socialize her so she could get into school. But she just could not leave the house without this little puppy, without having a meltdown. But there was no task it was trained to do. We encouraged the library to make a case-by-case exception and allow this particular companion animal, because clearly this was a service the girl needed. So if, like I said, the Department of Health comes down really hard on food venues that allow companion animals in. But if not, we do encourage folks to make case-by-case determinations on real specific situations where it's really clear it's necessary.
That really brings up a point in terms of the ADA. What it says is that a service animal must be allowed in a place of public accommodation. It does not say the companion animals cannot be there. That's up to the individual entity, the owner or the government agency, whatever, that is operating the facility. As Erica mentioned, certainly for restaurants, supermarkets, other kinds of entities that have food, fall under the state
health department,
right there. Thank you. I had a senior moment there for a minute. And they do not allow any animals in their premises except for service animals. Otherwise, it's up to the individual entity whether or not they're going to allow that companion animal in. but they must allow the service animal. That's a distinction.
So there's one more distinction I want to talk about under the ADA before we talk a little about the Fair Housing Act and where companion animals are allowed, is the difference between a companion animal and a psychiatric service animal. They do, psychiatric service animals do exist that are trained to do things. We got a call from a grocery store with a pharmacy recently because they were confused about this service animal. The lady had PTSD from being attacked from behind, and she has this little service chihuahua, and this dog's job is if somebody comes up behind her, like in line at the pharmacy, he goes around, sits 10 inches behind her on the floor, and yips twice. Alerts her to the fact that there's someone behind her and gives her just that foot of space between her and the guy behind, the person behind her, to make her feel comfortable with that. That's a psychiatric service animal. It's trained to do something to mitigate that disability. Another example we use is we talk about a soldier who came home from Iraq who had trouble walking into buildings because he'd been ambushed several times. So his service dog, when he goes to work in the morning, they've got a trained route it takes, and he opens the door and the dog goes in, and if it finds somebody in the office, it just sits down at their feet. If the dog doesn't come back in 5 minutes, he knows there's somebody in the building, and therefore he's not startled and he can go in. And he follows the same route the dog uses until he gets to whoever the person in the office already is, and then he sits there and talks with them as the dog continues the route. And if the dog doesn't come back in a certain amount of time, he knows there's a second person in the building all the way to his office. And that way he can come in, he can get in and out of his office. They do the same thing in his home when he comes home at night without the anxiety of being ambushed by somebody inside. So these are examples of psychiatric service animals. They're trained to do something to mitigate and alleviate a disability. There's a specific task. There are dogs that are trained to alert owners to oncoming panic attacks. They exist. They're trained to, again, notice mannerisms and behaviors a person might exhibit right as they're building into a panic attack and be able to alert the person that they need to get to a safe place. Those are psychiatric service animals. They're trained to do something versus the companion animal that just, it's mere presence, it's being there, and they're being able to pet it helps them calm down, but there's nothing the dog is trained to do to help. It's just there. So that said, I know we're running a little low on time.
Now, recently, there have been, as I said, a plethora of animals with service animal vests on. There is no dress code for service animals.
Yes.
The fact that the animal has a vest on and says service animal doesn't make it one. Neither are there any other certifications. There are no cards that you can get that your animal is a service animal. You can buy them online, but that doesn't mean they are. They may or may not be. So that doesn't need to be accepted. And someone has made a great deal of money selling the paraphernalia that would indicate a service animal.
Mm-hmm. And it actually is against federal law to misrepresent your pet as a service animal, but enforcement on that at the local level is pretty small, because we talked with the city recently about that, but concerns about police being called to restaurants in the middle of the day or evening to determine whether or not this person had a service animal seemed overwhelming to me and kind of not a good use of our resources. So a lot of communities are trying to figure out how they can enforce service animal laws and deal with people who are misrepresenting their pets as service animals. The other thing we talked about briefly is that service animals must always be under control of their owner, of their handler. And that's a really important one. That means they can't be growling or barking or jumping up on people. We had one at Art in the Vineyard about 3 years ago, 5 years ago now. We asked the lady to take her two service poodles out because she was intoxicated and they were just wandering through the food booths digging through trash. Well, they're not under her control at that point. So we asked her to go ahead and remove them from the venue. And so there's any number of things that can be considered out of control if they're not housebroken. Even if they're just sick today, if they're not housebroken and they can't get to a designated location, you can ask them to leave the venue. So the idea is if they're growling, they're angry, they're vicious, or they're barking or howling a lot in the middle of something. You know, they're just way too noisy. Because most of the time, a good service animal is trained. They'll come in, they'll sit at their owner's feet quietly, they'll get up and do the task when they need to, but they don't interact with people a lot. They don't bark and growl. We had one at Cuthbert Amphitheater last year who was very upset that we made her remove her service pit bull as it was lunging at people in the crowd while they were dancing. Well, again, there is a safety line there that we can ask that you remove the animal. Now, the important thing is once somebody's been asked to remove the service animal, they do still have to allow the person to continue to use the venue without that animal. So you can't ban a person for their dog's behavior. You can only ask them to remove the animal. And what? You don't have to let them tie the animal up to a pole outside either, because they'll do that. Well, I'll just go tie him up to the pole outside and come back in. Well, they haven't really mitigated the threat, have they? If the dog is now just right at the front door, barking and growling at everybody walking in. So, but yeah, if you ask them to remove the animal because it's out of control, you do still have to allow the person to utilize the venue and use your facilities and services.
Again, Erica is the example of a pit bull and a chihuahua. Any breed of dog can be used as a service animal. It does not have to be a collie or a Labrador. It can be any breed of dog. So, yes, a pit bull can be a service animal.
All right. So I want to talk briefly about the Fair Housing Act and rental properties, because that's the other question. That's where a lot of the confusion between companion animals and service animals comes into play. Because the Fair Housing Act, which governs rental housing, allows companion animals with a note or a prescription from their medical provider or their mental health provider. And that's where you get confused and people show up with letters from their doctor at a store. Well, those are meant for their landlords. So the idea behind the Fair Housing Act is that any owner of a rental property cannot deny a person with a disability the use of their service animal in their apartment or their rental unit, as well as any communal areas in the unit. So if there's a lobby with a fireplace in the apartment complex, they have to be able to have the service animal there as well. They also cannot impose any deposits or fees on a service animal. Even if they have a pet fee, they allow pets and they have a fee for pets, they still can't impose that fee on a service animal. They have to allow the service animal to live there, and they cannot charge them any fees. And that's the only time you can ask for medical documentation when dealing with a service animal is in, well, there's two, in rental housing and in a school. Those are the two. Because the schools will ask for documentation of the disability when they're writing the student's individual education plan to deal with the service animal and any needs the student may have. And so that's when they can ask for the medical documentation. And it doesn't have to be a prescription. It can just be a note from a counselor or psychiatrist saying that the animal mitigates one or more of the symptoms of their disability. And they can have that animal in their home.
There have been a couple of settlement agreements, several actually, in the last few years with schools and service animals. And the courts have consistently said the school must not only allow the service animal, the staff of the school must assist the child with the service animal, particularly if it's a young child. And so it has, the courts have designed this broad spectrum for service animals in the education arena.
I'm looking at you. We're looking at each other and trying.
I don't know what the time is.
We have a.
Someone has to just
somewhere.
Shut us
we
up.
Got about 5 minutes.
Because we would keep talking all day.
See, I know you can talk for another 5 minutes. We got about 5 minutes left, Dad.
I've got 5 minutes
yeah.
left? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now, service animals do obviously provide quite a few of the calls that we get are regarding service animals, and it's surprising after all these years. However, there is that people are becoming more aware of what they can say when you ask the two questions. And that's all you can do is ask the questions and take their answer at face value. And then if the animal is out of control or is not performing the tasks they say they're going to perform, then you can ask that the animal be removed. I mean, somebody could take their animal into a business and say, the animal picks things up for me when I drop them. But if you see later on, the owner of the animal is saying, oh, Fifi, get that paper off the floor, please. And the dog is standing there totally oblivious to what's going on. That's a good sign that the dog has not been individually trained to perform that particular task. And then you can go about asking the person to remove the animal.
I got one more thing. Service animals in training. I knew there was something we were forgetting. Okay, the federal law, the ADA, does not actually address service animals in training in any fashion. The state law in Oregon does. So businesses of public accommodation are required to allow service animals in training into their facilities, but the state law requires that that animal in training be wearing a special vest. So, but the state law does require that they allow service animals in training into public accommodations, because frankly, they've got to be socialized at some level at some point before they can serve their handlers. They have to experience crowds and learn how to deal with that. And so service animals in training tend to not be handled by somebody with a disability. They tend to be handled by a trainer until they're ready to be paired with their partner. But the state law does require that we allow them into places of public accommodation so that they can gain the skills they need to become the service animal.
And since Canine Companions has an installation in Boring, Oregon, that probably is part of the reason for that law, state law. And I think Hearing Ear has an installation in Southern Oregon.
So these are schools that train service animals. Hearing Ear, Seeing Eye, those are all schools that specifically train service animals and match them to a person with a disability. Typically, you go to that school for 3 or 4 weeks, get matched with your dog and individually trained with your dog as a pair before they bring you home, send you home with it. And those are pretty good installations. There's one in Colorado being sued right now for not training the dogs, but sending people dogs that they said were fully trained and ready to be service animals and had no training at all. So DOJ has just stepped in and sued that company. And there's another group coming in and training the dogs for free, because these people paid $800,000 to have their dogs trained and got dogs with not even housebroken back from this agency. So DOJ's in the process of shutting them down, and there's another agency in Colorado that volunteered to train all the dogs for free in their homes so that people didn't have to spend more money.
Now, the Department of Justice has been aware of the problem with people saying their animal is a service animal when it really isn't. And they've been looking more at the regulations, but as far as I know, under the new administration, there's no movement towards clarifying that regulation. It may be in the future, but there's no further clarification that I know of that's on the horizon.
Like I said, when I was talking with the city about it, we came to that same logistical, how do you enforce that without that taking a lot of resources from your police and your law enforcement? Because I can see it, especially, you know, late at night, you get, because I see when I go out to bars to do karaoke, people with their companion animals in the bar, and I know it's not a service animal, but, you know, we're not allowed to report anything we find to anybody. We're a confidential service. So I just, you know, but I see it a lot, and I can see that if we get into debates about it, the go-to answer is going to be call the police and have them decide. And that seems like a drain on our resources, and B, a little bit of a feeling of harassment for people whose service animals are legitimate, and they're trying to come into a restaurant with a real service animal, but they have to wait for the police to arrive to determine whether or not it's a real service animal. So it's part of it is the logistics of how do you enforce that without taking too many resources and without inconveniencing people with legitimate service animals too badly. And so that's part of why that's still kind of up in the air on both the federal, state, and local levels, is trying to balance that out is not an easy topic.
Part of the problem that we encounter is that there are a large number of homeless people who have dogs. They are claiming our service animals, and they can answer the two questions. And so it becomes an issue of, okay, what do we do with these animals? If the person wants to hang out in the library all day and has a dog with him that is just a pet, what do you, and so it presents a real conundrum for people in those kind of situations. Food for Lane County has had similar situations. I think they have kennels, don't they?
Yeah, at their dining room, what they've done for the dining room down across from the Well Hall, which is their soup kitchen, is out and back they have 7 or 8 kennels that people can put their dogs in while they're eating, their pets in while they're eating, so that they're only allowing the service animals into the restaurant. And then they can just cycle through those kennels. When this person leaves and takes their dog, the next person puts a dog in the kennel. And that way they can serve their population of people who are homeless and have companion dogs that are not actually service animals. So I thought that was kind of an ingenious solution for them.
Yeah. And still meet the health codes.
Okay, so I think that is about our time at this point.
Thank you.
If you have any questions regarding the ADA, we are available for answers. We may not have them, but we can find them.
And we have business cards on the table in the back. We also have information cards about our organization, Lila, back there, too.
Thank you very much. Now we'll take a break for about 5 minutes to formulate questions from each of the tables and then return with audience questions. Remember, only City Club members are allowed to ask questions from the microphone. So we'll be back in about 5 minutes.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the October 6th City Club program. Excuse me. Companion animals and service animals. What's the difference? Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Capella Market, AARP Oregon, Evans Elder Brown and Subert Commercial Real Estate, Gatos, Churnside and Balthrop Attorneys. And special thanks to University of Oregon Academic Extension, and Dotson's Photography, KRVM, 91.9 Radio. Before we go to member questions, remember, keep your questions short and to the point. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, Raisa Maddox, City Club member. I am going to ask you a question that you really, I may or may not know, but I thought I would ask, because we are seeing such an increase in food selling businesses of companion animals. What do you know is the fine that the health department could levy on food selling businesses if they are found to not be enforcing service animal only rules?
Unfortunately, I have to wait for my daughter to come back in the room. She's the one who knows the state code better than I do right now. And I'm not sure what the fine is. But when she gets back in the room, she'll be able to answer that question, I think.
Thank you.
Great. I wrote it down so we can ask Erica when she comes back.
Okay.
I'm Robin Fletcher, City Club member since 2004, I think. Has the increase in companion animals created challenges for those with service animals?
The
increase in companion animals created the challenges.
Yes, I think they have, and I think it's because they all get lumped together in people's minds, and they don't understand the distinction that a service animal is an animal that provides a necessary task, and the companion animal is just that, a companion. And I think that does provide difficulty, and I think that there is a certain amount of skepticism on the part of the community at large when they see an animal that says, when they say it's a service animal and it's not.
Thank you.
Hello, Ralph Pledger. I'm a member. I'm asking a question for a guest, and I promise not to make a speech. Is there any effort by LILA ADA team to educate businesses about ways to enforce the ADA rules?
We very much like to do that. We are available for consultation. As Erica said, we do surveys, physical surveys of buildings for businesses. We also can meet with businesses to discuss all aspects of the ADA, including employment, the service animals, as we are talking about today, but a variety of other kinds of issues as well. And if people get in touch with us, we are happy to accommodate. We also have what is known as the Blue Path program, and we haven't really discussed that today, but it's a program where businesses can sign on to a website that is posted that says they are basically accessible and welcoming to people with disabilities. We cannot certify that anyone is ADA accessible. Only the Department of Justice can do that.
And they won't.
And
great.
Skepticism raises its ugly head back here.
No, they told me they won't.
All right. So there was a question asked before Erica got in the room. Would you repeat the question?
Yes. The question I have is, what is the amount of money fined on a food selling business allowing animals? And that's a really good question, because I don't work for the health department, so I'm not honestly 100% sure what that fine is. If you guys have my business card, I have a cousin who works for the health department that's an inspector, and I can hit him up today or tomorrow and ask him, and then if somebody wants to email me on Monday, I can give you guys the answer to that.
But. Great, thank you.
Dan Solitz, member. My question is, what is the minimum certification required for a person to certify a companion animal?
A letter or note from their mental health provider?
The person signing the letter saying it's okay. That the landlord would look at and say, oh yeah, that person's qualified to say this person needs a companion animal.
It would be a medical provider or a mental health provider. So
this
even
is someone that has a degree and is certified as
a counselor or a psychiatrist or therapist. Yeah, but it can be their counselor or psychologist. It doesn't have
to be
an MD.
They have to be licensed by the state to certify that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That was good clarification.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. Kind of a hard question. The question is, every week I see newly homeless people. Almost all of them are people whose disability has prevented them from being regularly employed. And most of them are flat broke before they apply for Social Security. And I love LILA. Every week I send one or two people to LILA as a place to start their Social Security, because when those people are forced into living alone in our dark streets at night with a lot of predatory people, I think that having a big dog increases their safety. I meet people every week who've even had their shoes stolen. They lose everything they own night after night.
Jerry,
and a big dog make it good sense?
Thank you.
So, well, I understand what you're saying and have had lots of experience working with people who are unhoused as well, and understand the need for security and protection. The DOJ actually just came out last year with guidance on this very issue, because one of the things they list as a service is minimal protection. And so they needed to some guidance. When they say minimal protection as a service, they're talking about when they're a seizure alert dog, when somebody's on the ground having a seizure, they may be trained to roll them up onto their side and then kind of stand over and protect them from anything that might be coming at them while they're having the seizure. But they did clarify that they did not intend, when they said minimal protection, for that to include a guard dog or personal protection, an attack dog or a personal protection dog. Unfortunately, I understand what you're saying, and yes, I understand. Yes, having a big dog with you when you're alone on the streets makes a lot of sense. It does. Unfortunately, the DOJ's guidance has come down on the other side of that.
Ruth Dimmler. My question is, there are some communities where, such as Carmel and Santa Barbara and I guess numerous communities in California that are really on overload with dogs. Everyone has a dog there, I think. And I was wondering if you had any assistance from them as far as putting these policies together, because they're so accepted wherever you go, to every store, every restaurant, everything.
And part of that has to do with the Oregon Health Code and the Oregon Health Department. As far as restaurants and food service venues go, the Oregon Health Department is really strict about it. And I'm not, actually somebody just asked me that, something real similar on his way out. And I can't tell you exactly why the Oregon Department of Health is so strict and strong about that when other states like California are not. Some places get around it by having patios you can sit and eat on, and they can have, and you can have the dog in the patio, and it's not technically inside the building. And so I've seen that here when we were up in Astoria. I went on vacation in Astoria last spring, and everywhere we went, dogs were everywhere in every building, and they just had the patios on the outside of restaurants so they could take their dogs and sit on the patio and be okay. So I've actually seen that here in Oregon, and I'm not sure why it is our community doesn't do that as much. I've seen a few places that allow, like Hot Valley will allow dogs on the patio. But now downtown they can't because of the new city ordinance. Unless it's a service animal, it can't even be downtown. So.
But I'm going to ask a quick question before Dan's question. I was going to say, have people been experiencing a lot of hardship because of the city ordinance not allowing dogs in the downtown? Because I'm hearing from people that are fully able-bodied that go into restaurants downtown that have outdoor space and they bring their dog, and now they feel they can't do that. So have you also been coming across people that are having trouble with that ordinance? And do you know when it expires or if it's going to be continued?
I was a little confused when they passed it, because I seem to remember them passing the same ordinance in 1997. So I was kind of confused when they passed it again, because they actually banned dogs from the downtown park blocks in 97 or 98 initially. So I was a little, I don't know how long it's in effect, but I have not heard a lot from people. I'd have to talk to our independent living specialist to give you a real clear answer on how much they're hearing about that. Because when we talk to consumers, they're referred to us from our independent living specialists, which are our workers that help people get disability, find housing, teach job search skills, and connect them with the programs they need in order to live in the community. And so they tend to get most of the complaints, and we don't always hear them all. Mm-hmm. So
thank you.
Dan Bryant, City Club member since 96. The Oregon Fair Housing folk have been working to educate those of us in the community around the state who are in the business of providing shelter.
Yes.
And they've taken the position that if you provide shelter for someone and they're using your shelter as their mailing address, then in effect it is their residence. And therefore the fair housing laws that apply, and now folks doing shelter must accommodate companion animals. which does create some challenges for those of us who are providing shelter. So I'm just wondering your perspective on that, and if you have any suggestions. That it's not a big challenge for the organization that I am a part of, but I know for a place like the Mission that has 300, 400 beds to provide all of those folks space for their companion animals would be a huge challenge for them. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on how to resolve that.
Does the Mission allow for service animals and companion animals?
Well, they have to allow service animals, is my understanding, but not companions. So that's what I'm saying. If you use the Mission as your residence, right, then you would have to provide you'd have to provide reasonable accommodation or not.
The sticky situation with the Mission is that the Mission is under a religious organization exemption from the ADA. Churches are exempt. And so the Mission has frequently, so that is part of when we talk about the Mission, we recommend that they do, and I used to understand sometimes they do accept service animals, which is great, because the state law does not provide an exemption for religious organizations, but the federal law does. So that's kind of one of those really fine lines, specifically for the Mission. For other service and organizations, I would advise that even with companion animals, the requirement that the animal be under control and be housebroken and also groomed under control applies to service animal or to companion animals as well. So if they're exceptionally noisy, they're all over the place and they can't stay in a place, they can't stay out of the way, they're barking, they're growling, they're
dirty.
I hate to say dirty because it's hard for people who are homeless to keep their animals beautifully clean all the time. So I don't want to, when I say dirty, we're not talking like a couple of days worth of, you know, they've been on the street, but if they come in and they're mangy and their fur is gnarled and they just stink, that's kind of what we're talking about, that sort of thing. You can still deny access to the animal to any venue, including a shelter, if that animal is not under control. And so that is one protection you guys have when you're dealing with companion animals. As far as finding space for them, that's a little harder to deal with, I admit, because that's one of the issues they deal with in movie theaters and everywhere else is how do you apply space for service animals? And I wish I had better answers for you. Like I said, the dining room came up with a genius solution for non-service animals. But you aren't going to want to kennel somebody's companion animal overnight in a shelter. That's not going to function for them.
Quick question of clarification. Earlier you said that for someone offering housing, that they are not allowed to apply the pet deposit on a companion animal. Is that true?
That is correct. Now, if you have a policy as a renter that says that your tenants have to pay for any major damage done to the apartment after they move out, then if that companion animal damages the apartment, you can retroactively charge that tenant for the damage, like you would in any other situation. You can take it out of their deposit or in any other way that you would otherwise reacquire those damages from a former tenant. If the companion animal does significantly damage the apartment beyond normal wear and tear.
I think we have one more question. Yeah.
Yes, if a rental owner does allow a companion animal, can it require it to be neutered?
I don't think so. You can require it to be licensed and have proof of vaccinations and, you know, the state, the county basic minimums. I do not think they can require it be neutered. Most people with legitimate service animals do because it makes for a calmer service animal.
Yeah, I'm mostly referring to companion.
Yeah, but companion animals, yeah, you can't actually require they be neutered, I don't think. You can, like I said, we can require licensing and shots and all the basic county health requirements.
Thank you. Well, any last final remarks or anything that you wanted to enlighten us with before we end our program today?
The thing we end every training with? So our little acronym for the ADA when interacting with people with disabilities, and every training with this, is the ADA equals ask, don't assume.
Good advice. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Before we officially thank our speakers today, there's a few quick announcements. A thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing our City Club programs on Monday at 6:30 p.m. And a thank you to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club programs. Next week, on Friday, October 13th, Friday the 13th, please join us for a presentation from General Manager Frank Lawson of eWeb, eWeb's new strategic plan. More details and information about programs and City Club can be found online at cityclubofeugene.org. And now, thank you so much to Erica Organ and Eugene Organ from Lila. Thank you. And that concludes today's program.